Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Rose Castillo-Gilbo, member and former chair of the Board of Directors of the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco, and your moderator for this evening's program. In 2009, the citizens of the city of San Antonio, Texas, elected their native son and former city councilman, Julian Castro, to be their mayor. He is the youngest mayor to lead one of the most populated cities in America and in the state of Texas. In the summer of 2012, Mayor Castro took the national stage as a new face, and some say a rising star, of the Democratic Party when he gave the keynote speech at the Democratic National Convention, the first Latino ever to have the honor. Mayor Castro's work in San Antonio has focused on attracting well-paying jobs in 21st century industries, including those in new energy economy. To compete in the marketplace, Mayor Castro has made making educational opportunities available to his fellow citizens a top priority. From getting the little ones ready for kindergarten, the teenagers ready to college, and the adults trained for a retooled workforce. In 2011, the Milken Institute ranked San Antonio the nation's top-performing local economy. Now, this work has been organized around a vision that Mayor Castro created called SA 2020 that provides community goals to improve the city itself and to raise the quality of life for its citizens. Mayor Castro's identical twin brother, Joaquin, has served in the Texas House of Representatives and was just elected to represent Texas in the United States Congress. Together, they graduated from San Antonio Public Schools, went on to earn degrees from Stanford University and Harvard Law School. We are delighted to have Mayor Castro back in California. Please welcome the mayor of San Antonio, Texas, Julian Castro.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. First of all, thank you very much, Rose, for that introduction. It's wonderful to be here at the Commonwealth Club. It's also wonderful to be here with my brother. My brother Joaquin is right here in the audience. And so he says that the way to tell us apart is that I'm the ugly one. But the real way to tell us apart is that I'm the married one. And I'm 1 minute older than he is. It's also always a treat to be here in the Bay Area. 20 years ago, Joaquin and I arrived in San Francisco on Wednesday, September 23rd, 1992, after coming on a Southwest Airlines flight. It was only the second time that we had ever actually been on a plane back then. And our father had bought us probably the cheapest ticket that you could find between San Antonio and San Francisco. So we stopped in El Paso, San Diego, and then SFO, and cried all the way between San Antonio and El Paso, so much so that a flight attendant had the decency to come and bring us some of those coarse Southwest Airlines napkins to wipe our tears away. Today we had an opportunity this morning to get back to Stanford, and it was always wonderful to visit back there. It's also great to be back in the Bay Area because the Bay Area in so many ways is leading the way in this 21st century that we live in. And San Francisco is no doubt one of the unique cities of the world, an exciting city, so rich in culture, and has so much to offer America and the world in the 21st century. This Bay Area is also the place where my interest in public service was first sparked. As you may know, my brother Joaquin and I grew up in a household that was very active. My mother had been involved in the Chicano movement of the late 60s and early 70s. She was a hellraiser when she was young. And when we were growing up, she was involved part of the time in the old Raza Unida party and then in Democratic Party politics. And so she would drag us to rallies and to meetings and to organizational events. When we were 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, until we left at the age of 18, we hated politics. You know, who, when you're 11, 12 years old, wants to actually be dragged to a rally or a meeting? You know, you want to go to the movies or, you know, somewhere else. And so both Joaquin and I shared a real sort of disfavor, dislike of politics. But when we arrived, when I arrived at Stanford, what I saw there was a community in the Bay Area with a higher education level, higher income levels, that was more innovative, more entrepreneurial, focused on the technologies that would drive the late 20th and the 21st centuries. And it was the first time being away from home where I had the opportunity to compare the community that I had grown up in San Antonio with another community, and to see both the strengths of San Antonio and the weaknesses or what we needed to improve. And the same thing with the Bay Area. And so in San Antonio, I saw a community that was not as well educated, had lower income levels, was not on the cusp of 20th and 21st century technology the way that the Bay Area was, but also a place that, even though it was growing rapidly, still had a fundamental sense of community to it. I describe San Antonio as a place where if you're walking down the street and you pass somebody, that those two people still look each other in the eye. Or if your mail is misdelivered to the neighbor's house, the neighbor will actually walk over and give you the mail, not just write wrong address on the thing and put it back in the mailbox and so forth. And it's also a place where people of different cultures and backgrounds and faiths and so forth, over the decades, the generations have come together and have worked well together, lived well together. It was one of the first cities that was desegregated in the southwestern United States, hosted a World's Fair in 1968. In a very tumultuous time for our nation, San Antonio was stepping forward as a place that was bringing people of different backgrounds together. That's the city that I loved then and that I love now. And my interest in public service was in the question of how could you combine the best of those two communities? How could you create a community that is well-educated, that is innovative, that has high income levels, and also is authentic and feels like a community? And that's basically what I've tried to do as mayor of San Antonio. In fact, these days, we're focused more than ever on creating opportunity in our city. And that's really what I wanted to come and talk to you about in the next few minutes that I'll make remarks. Joaquin and I feel very fortunate in our own lives that we had the opportunity to graduate from the public schools of San Antonio, get out to Stanford, and then get out to law school and come back and to live out our American dreams of becoming attorneys and elected officials. I know that being a lawyer and a politician might sound like a nightmare to a lot of people, but it's actually what we wanted to do. And in San Antonio, we're very much focused on how we can make those opportunities and the American dream possible for folks, no matter what their lot in life. So I'm convinced that in this 21st century global economy, that brain power is the new currency of success, that human capital is the most important investment, the most important asset of any community. So after I got elected in 2009, the next year in 2010, we went to work on something that we called SA 2020. SA 2020 was basically a visioning effort that kicked off on Saturday, September 25th, 2010, that had a very simple question. What kind of city do we want to be on Friday, September 25th, 2020? That's a real date. That date will come around soon. And over 5,000 San Antonians participated in setting a vision for the following decade in San Antonio and a blueprint for what we could achieve in 11 different issue areas. And the most important one that they put on the table was the issue of education. You see, San Antonio for many years has faced a dropout rate that is higher than the national average and higher than the Texas average, that I would estimate at least a third of the population there that does not graduate from high school. Even as the economy has done very well, it's been judged one of the most recession-resistant cities, a lot to be proud of in the city, but still, many folks who fundamentally don't make it through the most basic hurdle of education. So we got to work. In 2010, we created something called Cafe College. Cafe College is a one-stop center in the middle of downtown San Antonio that gives expert advice to high school students in admissions, financial aid, and free ACT and SAT preparation courses. Because we found that the ratio of counselors to students in our public schools was one counselor to 420 students. So this old idea that you sit down with your counselor for an hour or something and you get this sagacious advice and dream about your future with them, that just wasn't happening. And Cafe College represents a concrete, pragmatic way that we can help fill that gap. Since 2010, Cafe College has almost doubled in size. It's served probably about 20,000 students by now. During its first year and a half, it had served about 11,000 students. Secondly, a group of us from City Hall, from the San Antonio Independent School District, and several other governmental agencies, as well as Trinity University in San Antonio, got together and started thinking about how we could solve the chicken and egg problem that exists in too many urban communities of neighborhoods that'll never get better because folks don't want to move in. The schools are poor. They're not up to par. And at the same time, it's difficult to get the schools up to par when the neighborhoods are falling apart. They're dilapidated. The kids of folks who grow up, the kids who grow up in those neighborhoods, as soon as they can get out, they get out, go somewhere else. We worked together and were able to secure over the last couple of years a Promise Neighborhood Grant from HUD and a Choice Neighborhood Grant from the Department of Education. And together, we're all working to improve the neighborhood and also improve the schools of Eastside San Antonio, which has traditionally been a heavily African-American and heavily Latino part of San Antonio and among the lowest achievement levels and the highest teen pregnancy rates in the city. And then third, this November, on November 6th, we did something that had never been done in San Antonio history. San Antonians voted to tax themselves. That's right, I said tax themselves. I'm in San Francisco, right? They voted to tax themselves 1/8 of a cent for the purpose of investing in high-quality full-day pre-K for four-year-olds in our city over the next 8 years. So San Antonio won't have universal pre-K yet. We couldn't afford that. But it will have as close to universal pre-K as any city in the state of Texas. All of that is underpinned by a belief that we need to ensure that folks never get behind in the first place. We need to ensure that from the very beginning of a young child's life, that he or she has the opportunity to succeed because they're getting educated well. And we've matched that focus on education with a focus on attracting and growing from within jobs in 21st century industries, like the biosciences and healthcare, which is now the largest economic sector in San Antonio, like the new energy economy. San Antonio owns the largest municipally owned utility in the United States, CPS Energy, that has more wind power and solar power under contract than any other municipal entity in the country, like information security, and the aerospace industry. I imagine that if we went around this room that there are some folks who went through San Antonio at one point and went through Lackland Air Force Base or Kelly Air Force Base or Brooks. I see one hand going up. And they used to do aircraft maintenance and repair. And so now that's been converted into private sector aerospace jobs with Boeing and Lockheed Martin and others that have come to the city. So we're focusing on creating the brain power that it takes to succeed in the 21st century global economy, and then matching that with a laser focus on growing jobs from within in 21st century industries and trying to recruit them to San Antonio. And it is paying off. As Rose mentioned, the Milken Institute ranks San Antonio as the top performing local economy at creating and sustaining jobs in 2011. I haven't seen the rankings for 2012 yet, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed. And more than that, it's helping to ensure that no matter what the dream is of each of the young people growing up in that community, whatever they want to be, that they can find their dream in that city. And go away if they want to for college or graduate school, but be able to come back to San Antonio or stay right there. San Antonio today actually has more than 110,000 students enrolled in college and graduate school. According to the Census Bureau, that's more than almost every other big American city. And city to city, it's actually more than the city of Boston, although not metro area to metro area. You know, I think they have MIT and Harvard and a few other universities. For generations, our United States of America has been built up with the philosophy that nobody is guaranteed success in life, but everybody ought to be guaranteed a chance to succeed. And we just went through a 2012 election cycle where the fundamental premise of this country, as it's known, the land of opportunity, was in an unwritten way, unspoken way, at the ballot box on November 6th. Whether we believed that everybody in our country ought to at least have the opportunity to succeed. The Republican Party did something that, in more stark terms than they'd done in a very long time. They divided folks between the makers and the takers, between the 47% and the 53%, between the job creators and, I guess, the job destroyers. I don't know what you'd call them. You guys remember that during the election. The idea was that if you're someone who's not making a certain amount of money, if you're someone who happens not to be paying income tax, federal income tax in a given year, if you're not an employer, then you're somehow less worthy of opportunity in the United States of America. And thankfully, on November 6th, Americans wholly rejected that attitude. What they said was that all of us count, that everyone ought to have an opportunity to succeed in our country. I bet if we went around the room, we can hear wonderful stories of families whose grandmothers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers, great-grandmothers came to the United States, people of modest means but big aspirations, and helped build up successful families, successful communities, a successful nation. At the convention, I had the opportunity to describe my own journey. Joaquin and I grew up with my mother and my grandmother. My grandmother had come to the United States when she was a young orphan, 6 or 7 years old, from Mexico, and dropped out in elementary school. Eventually, she worked as a maid, a cook, and a babysitter to help support my mother, who was her only child. My mother worked hard and graduated from high school eventually and then went on to college and graduate school. She worked hard as a single mother so that my brother and I could graduate from high school and then go on to college and go on to law school. And that's the American dream. And that's what we're trying to preserve in 21st century America. And when we turn on the news or read on the internet or pick up a newspaper, we see a lot about what other countries are doing around the world. And one of the things these countries are doing in spades is making investments in opportunity like they never have before to help ensure that more folks are well educated. They create the brain power of the future. How odd it would be indeed for the United States of America, that has set the blueprint for that kind of success, to roll that back in the 21st century. In San Antonio, we believe that we need to go in the direction that this country has always gone, to offer opportunity first and ask questions later. And that's what we're doing. San Antonio is special. San Antonio is now the seventh largest city in the United States. It's the second largest city in Texas. It's 63% Hispanic. In very many concrete ways, it represents a look at the Texas of tomorrow and the America of the second half of the 21st century. You remember that old song by Liza Minnelli that Frank Sinatra made popular, the theme from New York, New York? If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. So that was true of New York and other cities in the 20th century. In the 21st century, it's going to be true of cities like San Antonio. San Antonio really is the new face of the American dream, and I'm very proud to represent it. 20 years ago, when we arrived, Joaquin and I arrived at Stanford, we got here and we unloaded the three bags that we had of luggage that had been given to us at a going-away party a few days before. And the only reason that we were able to come to Stanford was that since my mother made just under $20,000 that year, we got Perkins loans and Pell grants, and we were able to do work study while we were here. In other words, we worked hard as individuals, and our family worked hard, but it was also the commitment that you, as citizens of the United States, were willing to make in us, and that you've made and are making in so many other young people and folks of walks of life throughout our nation. That's the fundamental beauty of the United States of America. And so as we look toward the future in places like San Antonio and San Francisco and throughout the United States, what we have always done of providing opportunity first, of believing that everyone should have a chance to succeed and then making the right investments for that opportunity, that's the formula for continued success in the future. Now, I love a lot of things about being mayor. One of the things I love is that I get to go into classrooms all over the city. And oftentimes I'll go into an elementary school, and the first thing that I do when I get into the classroom is that I ask them what they want to be when they grow up. And so I'll say, yeah, well, who wants to be an astronaut? And they'll raise their hand like only elementary school students do, because by the time they're in high school, they're trying not to look at you. You know, they don't want to have anything to do with you. You ask them if they want to be a doctor, and they raise their hand. Ask them if they want to be a lawyer, and amazingly, some people still raise their hand. And if we can get it right in this generation and extend that opportunity to them, that same formula for success, I believe, in this 21st century global economy is what will ensure that we turn their American dream into an American reality, and we turn this 21st century into another American century, to the benefit of us and the world. Thank you very much.
You know, you once said that great journeys can be made in a generation, and the path is just straightforward. So this pretty much describes your journey. Mm-hmm. You talked about your grandmother being an immigrant, and she was, your grandmother Victoria was an orphan who came to the United States. Your mother Rose, great name, was also struggled as a single mother to raise you and your brother very much. But both your parents were actively involved in politics.
Mm-hmm.
They were very active in that. So from what issues did they care about when you were growing up? What did you hear in the house?
Again, let me describe both my parents. My mother and my father met in the Chicano movement in 1968. Both of them were very active. My mother had gone to 12 straight years of Catholic school. And then she went to four more in a university, and was active in the Young Democrats, and then in a third party called the Raza Unida Party back then. There was kind of a Mexican-American third party. They had it here in California. But only in Colorado and Texas did it actually make the ballot. My father was also active. He was the head of a college, like a community college called Colegio Jacinto Treviño in San Antonio. So both of them cared about ensuring that Latinos had the opportunity to succeed, issues of civil rights, of education. They shared that passion. They split up when we were eight, and we grew up mostly with our mother. And she was still very active. Mostly, by the time we were getting older, she was active in women's issues. My mother had a red purse that she would carry to symbolize women's pay equity. I never knew what it meant until I asked her one day. She helped elect the first Latina that was elected a district court judge in Bexar County. She was very involved in the race campaign of someone who would have become the first Latina mayor of San Antonio. We've only ever had one female mayor of the city in the city's history. Now I'm thinking about San Francisco. Y'all had Dianne Feinstein, but I can't think of anybody else. So it was just always a very active time. And Joaquin and I grew up with the benefit of hearing stories, of going to the rallies, of being around her and her friends when they would have political conversations. And I think that we benefited a lot from that. If I have a worry about this generation of folks, it's that, especially in the minority community, a lot of teenagers don't have a full appreciation for the sacrifices that had to be made, the reality of previous generations, and that all of the opportunities that they do have now didn't just magically appear, that people really worked for those things over the years. And I think that history is lost a lot of times on it.
Well, she also ran for city council.
She did. Thank you for reminding me. I forgot that.
She clearly didn't win. So was there some residual, wanting for you to run, for the kids to run for office?
She was always very, my mother was very lenient. So, I mean, literally, we would watch Friday the 13th, the horror movie, when we were 12 years old, and we were able to cuss at home. I don't want to make it sound like it was that bad. I mean, we were respectful. But she ran in 1971 when she was 23 years old, and there were not single-member districts in San Antonio, so you had to run at large. As y'all know, that was a system that didn't particularly benefit anyone except the establishment business community that was there. We've seen that in cities across the nation over the years. And I don't think that she necessarily wanted us to run. She just wanted us to be people who were civically involved, whether that was our chosen profession or not. I think she would have been happy either way, as long as she knew that we were civically oriented, and she wanted us to do something for other people and not just for ourselves.
After you were elected to the city council, you ran for mayor, your first bid, and you lost. And what did you what did that loss teach you about winning?
I look too young. I'm just kidding. I think that, what it taught me was that I had to broaden my coalition. I needed to reach out to the business community more than I had in the first race. I ran in 2005, and I was 30 years old. I had served 4 years on the city council, and at that time, we had term limits. You could only serve in San Antonio 2 two-year terms, some of the most stringent term limits in the nation. So I did that. I got elected when I was 26, and then I ran when I was 30, and I lost in a close runoff to a gentleman who was 72, who was... 70 years old. He was one of the oldest mayors elected. What it taught me was that I needed to broaden my coalition, that I just need to let time pass also. You know, people credit you with experience and with earnestly trying again if you've been knocked down. I think people want to see that in somebody, that if you really want something for the right reason, that you're not just going to throw it away and say, well, okay, you know, I'm going to take my marbles and go. And so I ran again in 2009, and I won. Now, the gentleman who won in 05 did a very good job as mayor, and he was able to expand the term limits so that it's now 4 2-year terms, but it did not apply to that current council. So I'm able to serve 8 years.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's great. So you have another term, or how many more terms?
I'm coming to the end of my second term, and I'll have two more terms.
So, you know, Texans knew about you, Mayor of San Antonio and City Council, but, you know, the rest of the world really hadn't met you yet until that great DNC moment, right, where you addressed, you were the keynote at that moment. And tell me, how did you get asked, and what did you feel like when you were asked to be the first Latino to be on stage and to present?
Yeah, well, I got a call from Jim Messina, the campaign manager for the Obama campaign, and he said, I'm calling on behalf of the president, and I wanted to ask if you'd like to deliver the keynote address. I mean, what are you going to say? No? Yeah. So I said, well, of course, I'd be honored to do that. And I think that was like July 26th or 27th. It was a few days before they announced it on the 31st. And so right away, your head starts spinning about, oh, man. It is both super exciting and it is super nerve-wracking to have to deliver that speech.
Yeah. How did you prepare yourself for it?
I'm practicing it a lot. we went through about 18 or 19 drafts that I wrote and the speechwriter wrote and going back and forth. And so at the end of it, it was a kind of a collaboration, definitely. It's a teleprompter speech, right? Which is not something that a mayor naturally normally does, speak off teleprompters. I had done that just once for the Texas Democratic Convention in Houston a few months before, so at least I had a little bit of practice. But to answer your question, a lot of it just involved the mechanics of it. Y'all can imagine now that the networks only give 1 hour of coverage to these conventions. So they want to make sure if you're getting up there on stage, you don't have a Clint Eastwood moment. You know? I mean, that was the antithesis of what you should have, because in a good way, you want to put your best foot forward in terms of as the message of the campaign. And so they're very disciplined about the message and about the delivery of it. You know, and I joke around with Joaquin that, just to give you a sense of it, everybody had to go through sort of a dry run, a rehearsal beforehand. And there was a guy named Jim that was a veteran. He must have been like late 60s or 70. He had this cap of where he had served and stuff. And he had been doing this stage management forever. And he had his practice, because Joaquin was introducing me, he had his practice how we were gonna shake hands after he was done and I was coming onto the stage, how we were going to hug each other, and then how we were going to pivot our feet so that we didn't trip over each other when we were going in different directions. But you know, they take it very seriously,
yes,
to say the least.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you did a great job. So.
Thank you.
Now you've said, let's talk a little about education, because clearly this is an area that you're very committed and very passionate about. And I'm interested in how education, you invest in education for the business community. I mean, business, you have to have education to have business, right? But how does this work? How did this work for you and your brother in terms of coming up through? We mentioned that it has a low, you know, a lot of dropout rate, huge dropout rate in Texas. But how did this work for you? How were you able to take the opportunities that you've had?
I believe that it helped to have a very involved mother and father, you know, before that for a time. But that my father was a teacher, that my mother really got the value of education. She joined the PTA. I think she became vice president of the PTA early on when we were in elementary school, because she was literally the first person to show up to the meeting. And so they made her the vice president. But she, even though she was very, she gave us a lot of leeway in what we did. She also made sure that our homework got done, and that we stayed on task, and that we never strayed too far from getting good grades and so forth. So in her own way, she sort of shepherded us to academic success. And also the relationship that Joaquin and I had as twins. If anybody is a twin here, if y'all have twins, if you were unlucky enough to have siblings that are twins and be the odd person out, the competition between us growing up, you know, we used to compete in grades and in sports. And I'm convinced that the competition between us fueled both of us and helped us do better than we would have done if we had just individually been growing up. And so I think all of those things mattered.
This is a question from the audience. What is it like to have a twin brother along with you in politics? Do people get mixed up between you two? Can you switch places when giving speeches?
Probably not, yeah. I mean, this guy literally goes around saying that I'm uglier than he is, you know? No, it's very neat. I mean, the relationship between twins, I think, is a very unique relationship. It's a different relationship from any other relationship that one would have in life, because you share a DNA and you move through the world and the world kind of responds to you the same way. And physically you look the same, generally sound the same, and so forth. Growing up, I say that it was both a blessing and a little bit of a curse. It was a blessing because, even as corny as it sounds, I mean, I always had my best friend, right, everywhere I went, especially when we came out here to Stanford. That was important. But the part of it that was a little bit of a curse was that I never, you know, in having Joaquin, he was someone that was so much like me, a great friend, that I never felt compelled to go and make a million friends. You know, in high school, I would joke that I would talk to three people during the day, and one of them was my brother, and one of them was myself. So I don't know who the other one was. But if you're going into politics, that's not necessarily, you know, I'm not a Bill Clinton type of go talk to everybody, you know, for 5 hours and stuff.
Well, we have to talk about immigration. How would you describe the DREAM Act, and what is your position on it and its role in the immigration issue? And I also want to add to that I did get a question, and it's this person in the audience says, I am an undocumented immigrant brought to America by my parents when I was a baby. I do not have health care, and I do not know what to do.
Yeah. My first piece of advice would be, thankfully, because of the administrative policy decision that the Obama administration made, that there's hope, at least, for legal protection right now for Dreamers who are in the country. My hope is that the Congress will address this and pass the DREAM Act. As y'all know, there are different variants to it, but hopefully the DREAM Act will be passed. You know, I'm convinced that the place we need to start with Dreamers is that they're morally blameless. I mean, at 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, you're not choosing where you're going to go with your parents. It's not your fault that your parents brought you to the United States. And for a lot of these young people, this is the only country that they've ever known as home. You know, and many of them are very sharp. In San Antonio, we had two examples of folks who were valedictorians in their classes, in their high schools, who were Dreamers. One of them went to Harvard. So I hope we can pass the DREAM Act, that it and comprehensive immigration reform will allow for a full path to citizenship. With regard to comprehensive immigration reform, that there will be a path to citizenship if folks pay a fine that acknowledges that they did come in here, undocumented, illegally, whatever phrase you want to use, that they learn English, and that they get to the back of the line, because you don't want people cutting folks in line who have been legally in the process for a while, because one of the challenges that we have in the United States is that the legal immigration system is so broken down and the wait is so long that's part of what encourages folks who are on the other side of the border as well to try and take their chances and come here illegally. And you have to respect when folks try and do things by the book the way that they should. So if they can juggle those three things and also find a way that is secure so that when an employer hires someone, they know they can be assured that they're hiring somebody who is in the country legally, I think those four elements are the important elements to comprehensive immigration reform. I support that. I hope that my brother works on it in the Congress. And more importantly, I hope that enough members of the Republican Party will return to where they were in the late 2000s and be willing to consider it.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is the mayor of San Antonio, Texas, Julian Castro. Let's go back to education. There's a number of questions from the audience about education, so we're going to focus a little bit on this. This person is congratulating you on the passage of your tax finance, Preschool for All Children in San Antonio, and they want to know more about the importance of preschool education. And do you think this could be a national model, what you've done?
Mm-hmm. I hope that it is. I hope that it's at least a model for the state. So just briefly to describe it, Pre-K for SA was an effort of educators and the business community in San Antonio to essentially provide 22,400 four-year-olds with high-quality full-day pre-K over the next 8 years. And it accomplishes that in two ways. By establishing four model centers of pre-K excellence around our city that each educate 500 students, and also taking a certain amount of dollars and funding public schools, charter schools, and private schools that can leverage funding, public funding, if they're able to do that, to increase the number of seats they have in their own existing programs around the city. So at its height, from year four through year eight, it'll be serving 3,700 students every year. And that's going to help close a gap that exists of four-year-olds who don't get that now. I believe that it is a model, because it significantly expands pre-K. It does it by paying teachers more. The starting salary is going to be $60,000, which on the scale for Texas is significant. I think they start like in the low 40s right now in Texas. It has a longer school day to it that ends at 5:30. It will have robust teacher training of teachers from pre-K all the way to third grade, so that we enhance the level of teaching not just in those classrooms, but throughout San Antonio classrooms, and we try and maintain the gains that we make in pre-K into kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, which is important, because you can't just educate them well in pre-K and then let those gains drop off. You got to figure out some way to improve kindergarten and above as well. But more than anything else, what I hope becomes a model for Texas is that Texas is willing to make the investment in pre-K, because right now it only funds half a day's worth of pre-K for students, and it only funds half a day if you make less than 185% of poverty level, which for a family of four is about $42,500. If you're a military family, if you're a homeless child, if you're disabled, and there may be one or two other requirements, but basically the vast majority are people who are low income. And I think that we need to enhance that as well to middle class families and above, so that you can have a more universalized pre-K.
What about, can you speak a little bit about education for adults for the 21st century workforce?
Sure. One of the things that I'd like to work on in San Antonio is filling the skills gap that exists in our city and in most communities. We have a ton of people. And this is hard for me to say as somebody went to a four-year university and, like, I think everyone should go out and get their four-year degree. And I do believe that everyone should be so well educated that they have that option going all the way up through school. But we also have a tremendous number of folks who maybe they drop out and they never go back and get their GED and don't finish high school, or they finish high school but they don't go on to any kind of community college training or anything post-secondary. And at the same time, we have jobs in our community in the aerospace industry, in information technology, down there in the oil and gas industry. We're in Texas, after all. of people who can get a two-year community college degree or even certification and be able to make $50,000, $60,000, $65,000 after a relatively short amount of training to provide well for their family. Throughout American history, there was a more robust vocational training system that used to exist in our high schools that does not exist to the same level. And one of the things that we'd like to do in San Antonio is see how we can make, how we can create a great collaboration between our community colleges, our, the city of San Antonio, and our school districts to fill that skills gap by giving folks who want to a much more a much broader opportunity to get into certification training or get community college credits when they're in high school and be employable in one of those sectors right away.
Now, what advice would you give to President Obama on how to handle the upcoming debt ceiling issue?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm the mayor of a city, and so I won't pretend that I have more of the answers than he does. I do think that, he handled this latest round fairly well, all things considered. It's very tough when you're dealing with a party whose stated mission was to make sure that you're not reelected, and even after the reelection, it seems very intent on not compromising at all. My advice would be that when it comes to so-called entitlement reform, that I do think there are smart things that we can do that recognize that we need to reduce spending over time, that that we can implement changes that both meet the needs of our growing senior population, the baby boomers specifically, but don't fundamentally take away or change the commitment that this nation has had now for three generations to people in the United States, and this social safety net that exists that is so much a part of what it is to live in the United States of America. And so my hope is that there will be compromise, and there are going to have to be some cuts that are made, but that in the rush to compromise, that there won't be a fundamental making over, remaking of the social safety net. That's not what the United States needs. The United States needs to be smart about how it can control costs in each of these programs for the future, and be nuanced enough to recognize that the situation with Social Security is different from the situation with Medicare or with Medicaid, these other initiatives. Joaquin has described it very well. He talks about the need to create an infrastructure of opportunity, that just like we build out infrastructure, we build out roads, we build out bridges, we build out airports that basically get you from point A to point B physically. In the same way, you need to create an infrastructure of opportunity that gets you from point A to point B in life. You need to have great public schools, great universities, but also great healthcare system, Social Security, and so forth, so that you know, you have a great life and can live out your golden years all the way to the end.
So, you know, if the general public is as really strongly are concerned about what happened with the fiscal cliff with regard to Congress and the gridlock that was involved. What is your take on the economics on, and the political partisanship going on?
I would say that it's unfortunate that redistricting has created in the United States severe polarization. So that right now in too many districts, too many congressional districts, the problem is that the primary election is basically the election. And I don't, you know, I haven't looked at how California did so far. It'd be interesting and love to hear snippets of how people think that, the commission that was set up, how that all turned out, whether it was an improvement or not. In theory, it looked like it could be an improvement. But I would also say that what we have here is not an equivalency between the parties of polarization. We have here one party that is much more to the right than the other party is to the left. Now, I realize the irony of saying that in the city of San Francisco, but I do think on a national level that you have a Republican Party that has gone so far out to the right. I mean, we had the other day John Cornyn, our senior senator from Texas, say that a partial government shutdown could be healthy for the nation's economy in the long run. Y'all may have seen that. I mean, so somebody that's 80 years old, that's not going to receive their Social Security check because the government shut down, somehow that's going to be economically healthy for the nation. It's theoretical thinking, super conservative theoretical thinking that is not tethered as it needs to be to reality. I mean, too many times that's the case, and we see it there in Texas in spades. Fortunately for Texas, I think that the state is going to turn blue in 6 to 8 years, and partly because thank you. Partly because of that ideology and the refusal to compromise, they're losing the business community little by little. They're not making the investments in roads, in water, in education, in those things that are so important to be economically competitive in the 21st century global economy. So, you know, I'm disappointed like everyone else. I don't think that partisanship is going to change as long as we have these congressional districts that reward people for going out to the extremes of their party.
So I think that those of us in San Francisco probably view Texas as very conservative, you know? And we'd just like to know how you feel. Do you feel supported in Texas?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Texas used to be a Democratic state for a long time. Ann Richards was the last governor that was elected in 1990. And there's a new Texas. Demographic changes are moderating Texas significantly. Also, Texas has done relatively well during this downturn. And so we've had tons of people move in from California, from Nevada, from Colorado, Florida, other places that are more moderate. Now, I say that as somebody that was born and raised in Texas, but that are more moderate. I mean, I recognize that we have a very red state there. It's 29-0, 29 statewide offices, 0 Democrats in office. I think y'all have the reverse of that here. But places like Houston, like Austin, like San Antonio, like Dallas are already going Democratic. And even now, Harris County, Dallas County, Travis County, Bexar County for San Antonio, they're going Democratic. And soon, I think more of the suburbs will. It'll take longer for the rural areas, but it's changing. So I do feel like there's enough of a base of support for important changes.
Let's talk a little bit about the gun laws. Texas has a little bit different than the rest of the country. And both you and your brother, in fact, have spoken up about to support California's Governor Feinstein on the assault weapon ban. Can you talk about the gun laws and your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, Texas, there's no doubt that Texas has a gun culture. And I'll say that I support people being able to hunt with guns. The Supreme Court has interpreted the Second Amendment to say that people have a right to bear arms regardless of whether they're in a militia or not. So you're not going to get rid of the Second Amendment. People are going to have the right to bear arms. The question is, are there reasonable limits on that right so that we can have a safer America, safer for our children, safer in our workplaces, in our public places. So I think that there are reasonable steps that we can take, you know, closing that gun show loophole. What sense does it make that we have all of these restrictions if you go to a gun shop, but somebody can go to a gun store and be a terrorist or a gangster or mentally or whatever and buy a gun? It doesn't make any sense. Secondly, dealing with the issue of high-capacity magazines, the thing that the NRA can never answer is that the challenge you have is the element of surprise in any encounter. So when Representative Giffords was approached by the young man who, you know, had a similar assault weapon, I mean, the guy can get off 30 rounds before anybody can do anything. There's a security guard there. You're always going to have that element of surprise, and what you want to do is you want to be able, in a reasonable way, to limit how damaging somebody can be in that kind of moment. On top of that, I think that ensuring that there's better collaboration between states and the federal government so that databases are up to date, that they're thorough, so that when a gun check, when an ID check is done, you know, it's as thorough as possible. I don't think that we're as thorough as we could be right now. So y'all can imagine that in Texas, it's always about balancing those two things.
So, you know, well, for decades, Americans have been talking about the Latinos as the sleeping giant. And they kind of woke up at this last election and were very influential in the presidential, you know, vote. How do you think Latino voters are going to influence the future of the United States in terms of issues like immigration, education? And is it just, is, you know, that's just a specific Latino issue, or what? How would you describe that?
Well, I'd say that, you know, that the Latino community is a very diverse community. As y'all know, people coming, you know, who are of Mexican heritage, Guatemalan, you know, Cuban, Honduran.
I mean, here in San Francisco, is,
yeah,
it's Central American primarily.
Yeah, y'all see it all, you know, and it's tied together by the Spanish language historically, but different views, different life experiences, and also different generational presence in the United States. I mean, New Mexico and Texas, here in California, you have Latinos that have been here for five generations or more. And so the answer to your question is they're going to do what they've always done, which is contribute in a very positive way to the progress, the forward progress of the United States. I remember, for instance, reading at the height of the Iraq War, there was a New York Times article about one city that was bucking the trend of the challenge that the Army was having in recruiting folks. Yeah, nobody wanted to go, or a lot of people didn't want to go during that wartime. And the city they were writing about was San Antonio. San Antonio has a huge Latino population, very proudly American, and with a high incidence of people who volunteer to go and serve in the nation's military. And you can write that story in Latino communities all over the United States. It's also a community of faith. It's a community with a hard work ethic. So all of those things, the work ethic, the faith, the pride in the United States, those are the values that have helped make our country great in the first place. And the growth of the Latino community, I think, is going to be a replenishment of the values that have always made the United States great.
So what do you think? What do you think is the most pressing issue for the Latino community today?
Education. Yeah, even though immigration reform has received the lion's share of attention, the fact is that the dropout rate in the Latino community is higher than just about every other community, that the fundamental ability of people to enjoy the fruits of America, to pursue their American dream, is being hampered because too many of them are going to school in public schools that are decrepit, that aren't high quality. You know, their dreams are stunted. And oftentimes they don't have a chance that they should have. So I think that's the most pressing concern. And then, of course, immigration reform and health care would be after that. The Affordable Care Act is going to mean that up to 9 million more Latinos have the opportunity to get health care. For too many folks, Latino or non-Latino, too many Americans, the emergency room is basically their primary care physician. And they show up on the doorstep of the emergency room if they have a real problem. And if they don't have a big problem, they don't go to the doctor. You know, and so I would put that as one of the big issues as well.
Do you feel any pressure being Latino to be a poster child for the Latino community?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that in my job as mayor of the city, that I know that fundamentally when you're elected to office that you have to represent everyone. I mean, that's the first thing that I see, is so what is a good policy for the city? Of course, I'm also sensitive to the fact that I am Latino and I take pride in that, but I don't want to be defined by that. You know, I don't want that to be the first thing that people think when they think about me as a public servant. And so, it's always a challenging, both responsibility, I guess a responsibility, and also sometime a limitation, because I think that people should judge public servants first on what policies they, you know, they embrace and they're pushing before they do on any kind of affiliation. At the same time, I recognize that the Latino community is a community that too oftentimes is voiceless. And so as a Latino, I can help do something about that. And finding that balance is something that I'm constantly trying to do. And so I can't say that I have the perfect formula for it yet.
Well, you certainly are a leader, and you're a very well-recognized leader. Tell me, what do you think those qualities are that a leader should have?
I believe that a leader should have, I think, first of all, people want in a leader someone of integrity. I'm not talking about myself. I'm talking about general leadership. I mean, they want people of integrity that they can trust. And then, secondly, a leader has to have a vision of what they want to accomplish, he or she wants to accomplish. I have a very strong vision for what I want to do in San Antonio. I want to create a brain power community that is the liveliest city in the United States in our community. And a leader has to have the skill to articulate that vision, to get others to, you know, get excited about that vision, and then be able to surround himself or herself with people who can help execute that vision effectively. That's what I see as leadership.
In San Antonio, your San Antonio 2020 vision is very ambitious. I mean, it covers everything from education to business to the environment, volunteerism. I mean, it just goes on and on. How is that doing?
It's doing well. So after the 2020 vision process was completed, what we did was that we formed a nonprofit organization, SA 2020, that organization is charged with connecting nonprofits and the business community in working toward those numeric goals that we set. So, for instance, one of the goals that we set was that by third grade, I believe it's 90% of our third graders would be reading on grade level, because the research demonstrates that third grade reading is a pretty good indicator of somebody's educational trajectory. So we've gotten companies and nonprofits to align behind that goal. They say, okay, if we're giving money for education, we're going to give money to the effort to get to that 90% goal. We're going to reward nonprofits that are working toward that goal. And it's, you know, we're about a year and a half into that process, and so far so good. In March, we'll have our first report card on the different measures, and I'll have a better sense in terms of where we're at. We contracted with the Texas data center that is housed in San Antonio to actually do the analysis on all of these things, so that it's evidence-based, it's rigorous. It's not just, well, we think that we've made some progress here. We'll get that first report card in March. So I'm, you know, keeping my fingers crossed.
Well, you have a lot of very bread-and-butter issues in San Antonio, to education, business, et cetera. What about things like the climate change, gay marriages? How do those issues play in San Antonio?
With respect to marriage equality, gay marriage, I've come out and said that I support it. I believe that it's a travesty that it's in the United States we haven't done it sooner. I believe that we're going to look back in 30 years and it's going to be seen in the same way that we saw laws that prohibited people of different races from being married. You can see that changing, you know, the change that is afoot on that issue. And so I'm pleased with that. Same thing with a whole host of other social issues. San Antonio, I think, is a little bit more progressive than the state of Texas. Not as progressive as Austin, but more progressive than a lot of the state.
And the environment?
So we've embraced, we had something called Mission Verde, which Verde, of course, is green, that the previous mayor launched. And so, as I mentioned in my remarks, we've pursued investment in renewable energy very aggressively in wind and solar. We've worked on the plastic bag issue. We've increased recycling in our community, taking it from 4% to almost 30% in the last 5 years. And
I've supported climate change legislation, so we're trying to do what we can on that issue as well.
So we have time for one more last question. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when Barack Obama was given the opportunity in 2004 to speak at the DNC, 4 years later, he became President of the United States. So what is your political ambition? And I want to tell you here that this person said that he hopes you'll be a candidate in 2016. And viva Julian Castro.
Well, thank you to whoever. I'll pay you later, whoever that was.
It wasn't your brother, I don't think.
Yeah, it was probably Joaquin. Yeah, no, I mean, that's very flattering, but I also think that President Obama is somebody of unique talent and ability, and I wouldn't put myself in the same league as President Obama. I'm the mayor of a city.
No.
You know, and everybody in your life, you know, you have in your gut this sense of what your future is. And I've never had the sense in my future that I'm going to be president, you know. And so I just don't, it's like somebody saying to you, you know, you're going to be the star athlete or NFL football player. I mean, what? It's not something I think is ever going to happen.
Then what's the next step?
I'll be in San Antonio for a while. I have 4 more years after this year. And then I've told folks there that if I do a great job, that I'll look around in Texas and see what's happening in that point and look at perhaps running in the state of Texas.
Our thanks to the mayor of San Antonio, Texas, Julian Castro.
Thank you. Thank you.
We also want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Rose Castillo-Gilbo, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
All right.